online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
If the government is serious about having a local industry, it needs to step in and take a look at the situation, because local industry may just slowly peter out and die if we're not careful.
That's a call from the medicinal cannabis industry for the federal government to help it compete against lower grade international imports. And also, oil prices rising. What does that mean for fuel at the pump?
We'll clearly see prices rise over the next few weeks. There'll probably be a 1 to 2 week lag from the recent rally. We could see it clearly back over $2 a litre.
What have you noticed? Have you already noticed some price rises at the fuel pump? Send me a text 0438 922 936. Tell me what you're paying for your fuel, and can you afford to pay more, as it sounds like prices will continue to rise. Send me a text 0438 922 936. But first, Australian medicinal cannabis growers say the emerging industry is struggling to survive due to what they say is an influx of imported cannabis products flooding the Australian market without testing by Australia's medical regulator. One of Australia's biggest cannabis producers, Can Group, announced last month it had been suspended from the Australian Stock Exchange over cash flow concerns. Other major companies say Can is not alone in its financial struggles. They're calling for urgent government regulation of cheap imports, they say, are killing the local industry and putting patient safety at risk. Elsie Kennedy has the story.
Australia's cannabis industry launched to great fanfare in 2016 when cannabis was legalised here for medicinal purposes for the first time. 8 years later, companies say they're struggling financially as cheap imports have flooded the market, sending minimum prices for cannabis plummeting.
More product pushed into this country at a cheaper price without the kind of cost regulations and challenges that we have does create a very, very difficult situation for us to maintain our revenue growth.
That's outgoing CEO of Can Group, Peter Coetzee. He's calling for urgent government regulation of cheap imports he says are killing the local industry and putting patient safety at risk.
If the government is serious about having a local industry, it needs to step in and take a look at the situation, because local industry may just slowly peter out and die if we're not careful.
Can Group is one of Australia's oldest medicinal cannabis producers and has invested $170 million in building a high-tech facility on the outskirts of Mildura on the New South Wales-Victorian border. The company is now offering the facility for sale and says it will lease it back in an effort to bring in cash to stay afloat.
You don't take light decisions about moving away from owning that facility and continuing to want to invest in the purpose that it was built for. And I have to also say that it's only now that that facility is really starting to deliver after a lot of years of trial and error and construction. That facility is now starting to deliver the best quality product in Australia.
Are you looking at laying off any staff at this stage?
Look, at the moment, we are always looking at those things. The preservation of our facility in Mildura, which is the engine room of the business, is paramount to us. So the idea of trying to maintain as best we can, but there comes a point at which cash flow becomes an issue, and cash flow requires you to take action. So it's not without challenge.
According to industry modelling, about 80% of the medicinal cannabis sold in Australia is imported, taking a big slice of sales in a sector estimated to be worth about $400 million. Data from medicinal cannabis clinic Honolii shows that between January 2022 and January 2024, the minimum price of medicinal cannabis flower products plummeted 57%, from $11.90 per gram to $5 per gram. It's not just Can Group worried about the impact on the local industry. Other medicinal cannabis companies say they're concerned these cheap imports are not being tested by Australia's medical regulator, making it impossible for Australian companies, which must comply with strict standards, to compete on a level playing field.
A lot of people aren't becoming cultivators because of the concern of the financial viability.
That's Nanree Skouri, CEO of Northern Victorian cannabis company ECS Botanics. She says as well as the financial impact, she's worried about patient safety.
I guess the concern for us is the regulators said they would make sure that they'd monitor the industry, that they would check that the products did meet specification. But what actually happened is they haven't tested any product, and I don't believe they've checked on any of the packers to make sure they're following the regulations. That's a concern for us because if the product isn't of the highest standard, this product is used by really ill patients, people with cancer, MS, Parkinson's, and they want to make sure that the product that they're taking is healthy and clean.
What is the potential effect of the way things are going if it's not corrected?
I guess what will happen is the brand will be damaged. So there's a lot of scepticism around medicinal cannabis, and doctors are only just getting to the point where they feel more trusting and using it as an alternative medicine. If we have product out there that is not of the highest quality, then there's a risk that the doctors will become concerned about that because it's not being treated as a pharmaceutical. It's being treated more like a food product or some sort of nutraceutical, and doctors will lose confidence. And that's obviously a concern for the industry because we do believe that medicinal cannabis has a place as a pharmaceutical product.
Australia's Therapeutic Goods Administration has confirmed it hasn't tested any imported medicinal cannabis products in the last 12 months. Australian Medical Association President Steve Robson says there's been an explosion in the number of Australians prescribed medicinal cannabis, and doctors don't have enough information about the quality of the product coming into Australia.
These are important medications for Australians, and we need to make sure that they have good quality medications if they're being prescribed, particularly in the volume that we're seeing at the moment.
The TGA said in a statement it applies the same regulations to medicinal cannabis as it does to other medicines. The TGA said, quote, "We do not routinely perform testing of any medicines prior to supply, with the exception of selected vaccine batches, and do not have the resources to do so," end quote. The TGA said medicine manufacturers are responsible for ensuring their products meet quality requirements.
That story from Elsie Kennedy and Tyrone Dalton. And Tasmanian Botanics has been pushing for changes to regulations around labelling of medicinal cannabis. It's in the process of tripling its production at a manufacturing facility in the state's south. CEO Dan Howard admits imports have a wide-ranging impact on the sector.
I think it affects all businesses. Effectively, you are changing the supply, the supply side of the supply-demand equation. And while I truly believe that imported cannabis, there's plenty of high-quality facilities out there, the issue is that there is no cap or target for the ODC on how much is being imported. They don't reconcile with how much is being produced domestically and how much demand there is domestically. So what we're getting is these, tens of thousands of kilos being imported when in most cases there's sufficient domestic supply to satisfy that demand. And so it's impacting all Australian growers, and we're seeing more and more of that with several either going into administration or being suspended on the share market due to lack of financial viability. I worked in the industry in Canada for a number of years as it grew, and I was unsatisfied with the direction of the industry in Canada, in that it was more and more desperate financial situations of companies who overinvested or poorly invested, and I thought Australia was the best place in the world to be from a growth perspective, from the regulatory and the quality of product that is being put out in Australia is very good. And so I thought that if I could take some of those learnings, those hard-earned learnings from Canada, and deploy them here, I think it could be successful. And I think we've managed to do that in a fairly major way. But it's a fundamentally a very different market, in that Canada is regulated very much like a recreational market, with rules that are appropriate for that level. In Australia, being a pharmaceutical or a medical-only market, we have a very different set of rules here. You need to understand what you're consuming and you're putting in your body. And so whether it's says it's higher than it really is, lower than it really is. This is a nascent industry. It's hard enough. We're building credibility as an industry. And so if a patient has inconsistent experiences with cannabis, they're not going, and it's due to deceptive testing or just improper testing, it's just one more hill for the industry to kind of climb to establish legitimacy. And so independent GMP, you know, compliant testing in Australia, I think, should be compulsory for all imported products.
That was Dan Howard from medicinal cannabis manufacturer here in Tassie, Tasmanian Botanics.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
A government report says there is an increasing risk of a bird flu outbreak in Australia. The latest H5N1 strain of avian influenza has been spreading around the world, including recent discoveries in Antarctica and in dairy cattle in the US. So far, Australia has remained free of the strain of the virus. Chief Veterinary Officer Dr. Beth Cookson says the government is watching bird flu developments around the world closely.
We have been closely monitoring the global spread of high pathogenicity avian influenza or bird flu since around 2020. And of course, what we've seen with that is an increasing number of wild birds that are able to be infected with the virus and transmit it longer distances than we've had before. As a result of that, the department has commissioned a risk assessment, and really the conclusion of the risk assessment is that there is an increasing risk to Australia from bird flu arriving with wild birds. But importantly, the drivers of that increasing risk is really about the impacts that we're seeing globally in birds affected by HPAI.
So how does that increased threat change your preparations, or does it change your preparations for the threat of this disease?
We have been working on Australia's preparedness arrangements to make sure that we are able to respond quickly and effectively if needed. We do already have well-established response plans through AusVet Plan, and that provides the guidance documents that we work to in managing any outbreak of bird flu. With the change in the way that we're seeing the virus operating and impacting wild birds, the work we have been doing most recently is to make sure that we're working very closely, particularly with our colleagues in the environment sector, to make sure that we're able to respond to that situation if we did have bird flu in our wild bird population.
And this current strain of bird flu, most recently reported in cattle in the US and now a human case in the USA as well, that's different to previous outbreaks of avian influenza in Australia, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right, Warwick. What we've seen with the current circulating strain globally, and I should at this point just remind listeners that Australia remains free, of course, from bird flu. But what we are seeing with this currently circulating strain is that it can spill over into other mammal species. Mostly that's when those animals are in close contact with sick or dying birds, and that's the way that the virus is transmitted. What we've seen reported from the United States in the last couple of weeks is that there now has been a number of cattle herds also infected by high pathogenicity avian influenza. Now, this is the first time that cattle have been infected with these viruses, and we understand that infection may have been introduced initially into one or more of those herds from wild birds. However, it is a rapidly evolving situation in what's known about the occurrence of avian influenza in these cows, and we can't yet rule out that it's not being introduced to new areas by movement of the dairy cattle.
Obviously, livestock, huge proportion of the agriculture sector in the US, obviously a big proportion of the Australian agriculture sector as well. So the fact that it has jumped to livestock elsewhere in the world, is that a concern?
It's certainly very much something that we're monitoring, including being in direct contact with my counterpart, the Chief Veterinary Officer of the United States, to understand. It's still a low risk to Australian dairy cattle herds. We have good risk mitigation around any imported product. So we are still talking about the situation where wild birds might bring in this particular strain. And of course, we need to understand more from the United States situation as to why the disease was able to move into the cattle and whether that would be replicated in other situations.
And Australia, I think, together with New Zealand, almost the last places in the world not to have this particular strain of bird flu, given it's in Antarctica, given the situation in the US, and given so many migratory birds fly to Australia from elsewhere in the world, do you have any insight on how we've been able to remain this strain of bird flu free for so long?
Australia has a very long history of monitoring different avian influenza strains in our wild bird populations. And so what we know from that monitoring is that we rarely get new introductions of strains of virus from overseas through those migratory bird pathways. What we are watching very closely now, of course, is that with more and different types of bird species being infected globally, whether that will change the situation that we've known over the last couple of decades.
And that was Australia's Chief Vet, Dr. Beth Cookson, speaking to Warwick Long. Farmers say Dr. Emerson's report on supermarkets is a good first step, but a long way from fixing problems. David Johinke, the president of the National Farmers Federation, says more needs to be done.
Well, first of all, we obviously welcome the report. It's actually hitting the frustrations that producers have felt throughout this process, and we're really pleased that those thoughts have been captured by having a conversation around making the code mandatory, by making sure the penalty's in place, making sure we've got transparency, but also making sure there's penalties there. And just to be clear, the NFF currently doesn't have a divestiture policy, though we do want to make sure the penalties are fit for purpose, and that's something that we still want to work through as a collective of the whole NFF family.
Does the idea of making the code mandatory between supermarkets and farmer suppliers appeal to farmers?
Everybody who's been involved in the process definitely believes that this will be a good step forward. It's not the whole picture, though. It is a segment of the supply chain that it does support, but the supply chain is greater than just that one transaction as well. But it's for us, and listening to farmers and hearing their concerns, definitely a step in the right direction.
The idea of a confidential complaints process is part of the code, but to wield a massive fine that could be 10% of the turnover of a company that would end up being billions of dollars, I'd imagine there would have to be a test of this in court, and farmers would still have to put their neck on the line, wouldn't they, to make accusations about the conduct of a supermarket?
It does two things. First of all, it gives the mechanism, yes, but secondly, it supports the people who speak up and also make sure that there's a protection mechanism in there as proposed to ensure that they don't get commercial retribution back for speaking up. So, yes, there's still going to be a process to follow. We're wanting to understand a little bit more on what that looks like as far as either the involvement of getting the code to be activated so that farmers are protected, but then secondly, is there what kind of costs would be involved? Noting that you're quite right, the penalties are quite large, and this is what we want them to be as a deterrent so that we don't get to that stage, so that we understand that there's a stick that we can pull out. So for us, it sounds really positive. This is the interim report. We want to know a little bit more as well, but it's all heading in the right direction as far as we're concerned.
Yeah, it's a major change, but do you really think it will change much in terms of farmers' relationship with supermarkets?
I'm hoping so, Warwick, I really do, noting that this is one of the many inquiries that are going on to this sector, but the first cab off the rank. And I guess it really, all of this conversation comes down to when a dispute occurs or when there's a negotiation that falls apart, how useful is this? We believe in our conversations, and once again, this is going to help, but ultimately we won't know until The rubber hits the road and that first case gets brought forward or the first circumstance comes forward. And we want to make sure that there is a review process in this as well, once again, to ensure that that these settings are constantly fit for purpose. As we know, when rules are changed, when guidelines are made, we want to make sure that we're capturing as much of the traffic, as much of the contracts, as much of that farmer negotiation as possible.
What other changes would you like to see in the supermarket space that you're not currently getting either from the Emerson report or the other reports that are currently ongoing looking at supermarket behaviour?
Well, noting that this is the interim report and there's still a food feedback process to refine the outcomes of this, I guess our call is that all farmers should be involved in this process. That people should be understanding that this is an opportunity to change the settings between that relationship in the supply chain. Now, I'm no marketing guru here, Warwick, but what I do know is that the frustration we've heard through this inquiry means that something's got to change in this relationship, and giving more balance to farmers is the first step in that conversation. Also noting that our population and our tyranny of distance in Australia is also a challenge, and I don't want to see us have a weakened supply chain either. So I don't have the answer to that question, Warwick. What I do know is the frustrations that we've heard in this means that we do need meaningful change and we do need the power balance to be more equalised. Once again, we welcome the report and we actually are very pleased with the recommendations that are coming out so far.
On this, at least, it's a tick from the National Farmers Federation for the federal government.
Well, it's a tick into this current inquiry, noting that there's other inquiries going on too. And we're very interested into the ACCC inquiry, which we believe will uncover even more information and also have a bit more teeth along the supply chain, more than just that one, than the final transaction to the retailer and that direct relationship there. There's a lot more to be discussed as well.
And that was President of the National Farmers Federation, David Johinke, speaking about the recommendations from the Emerson report about supermarket prices. Speaking of prices, motorists are being warned the price of petrol is set to climb steeply in the coming weeks. It follows a spike in the oil price. It's now trading at its highest level since October last year. Analysts say the price is going up because of cuts to supply by OPEC, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, and concerns about rising tensions in the Middle East. More from business reporter David Taylor.
The spike in the oil price has rattled international financial markets.
Oil going up, I mean, that's a big deal, and I think that's really what drove the market today.
The price of Brent crude, which helps determine what Australian motorists pay at the pump, rose 1.6% this morning to over $90 a barrel. It's the highest level since October last year. The ANZ Bank's senior commodities strategist, Daniel Hines, says the oil price has been rising steadily for 6 months.
The gradual nature of the recent performance, I suppose, doesn't bring to mind, you know, the screaming headlines that you would normally get with such sort of level.
At the heart of higher oil prices, says Daniel Hines, is the concern that other big oil-producing countries will be drawn into the Hamas-Israel conflict.
It's been something I've been focusing on for quite some time and sort of been concerned, you know, about its possible escalation, and now that it's happening,
because the oil price is effectively saying it is escalating.
Exactly. I think it's getting to a point where there is real concern now, and I think the market's probably, or the broader sort of market, hasn't really picked up on those issues just yet.
He says he expects the oil price to climb further in coming weeks.
The market is relatively tight, and we have OPEC, the world's biggest producing group as a whole, continuing to constrain supply, even though there's these risks to disruptions within the Middle East. And, you know, the consumption or demand for oil is getting better, particularly in markets like the US and in China. So, yes, I think it's got a little bit further to go, at least over the next few months.
So what does all this mean for the price of petrol at the pump? Well, as a general rule of thumb, the price at the bowser rises roughly 10 cents per litre for every $1 increase in the oil price.
Look, I think we'll clearly see prices rise over the next few weeks. As I said, I think there'll probably be a 1 to 2 week lag from the recent rally. Yeah, we could see it clearly back over $2 a litre, at least here in New South Wales in the next few weeks.
Peter Curry is a spokesperson for insurance and motoring organisation NRMA. He says he also expects petrol prices to start climbing.
Since Easter, the average price in Sydney has been around the high 180s. It will creep above $1.90 if it hasn't done so already. And then it will continue to rise on account of the price cycle in other parts of the country, you know, depending on where you live. And so that'll probably happen in the next week or two, probably over the next 7 to 10 days.
It sounds like, though, you're more referring to the petrol price cycle in itself as opposed to the higher oil price leading to higher petrol prices.
Yeah, so but the two are combined. The two are connected. As the oil price goes up, the high point of the cycle will also increase. And that's why we're expecting the next high point in Sydney to go above $2.10 a litre, which it didn't do previously. And if these increases continue, because not just the global oil prices are going up, but the wholesale price is also going up, then that $2.12 mark could also go even higher, depending on what happens with both oil prices and the wholesale price.
Well, Peter Curry, not putting too fine a point on it, but it wouldn't be so silly for motorists to fill up.
We would absolutely encourage motorists to fill up. So if you haven't filled up yet, if you missed out on the bottom of the cycle before Easter, don't delay any longer, because those prices are just going to go up every day.
NRMA spokesperson Peter Curry. Time for the news headlines now with Michael Dalla Fontana.
Thank you, Fiona. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says there's no plan to expand the AUKUS partnership beyond the three countries already involved. The alliance between Australia and the US and UK is considering including Japan in some of its so-called Pillar 2 projects, particularly involving technology. The incoming head of the Australian Defence Force says he recognises the importance of continuing to improve the culture of the force. Vice Admiral David Johnston will replace General Angus Campbell to lead Australia's armed forces in July, pending approval from the Governor-General. New data shows Australians are continuing to retire at their oldest age since the early 1970s, with men in Melbourne the oldest retirees in the nation. The figures from KPMG show the expected retirement age for men was 66.2 years and 64.8 years for women in 2022-23. And Australian amateur golfer Jasper Stubbs says it was a thrilling moment when he received his invitation to the US Masters at Augusta National. The 22-year-old will be one of six Australians in the field when the first men's major of the year starts later this week. ABC News.
Thank you, Michael. Time now for the weather, and across to the Weather Bureau, Ellie Matthews. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Fiona.
Now, can you tell me if there was much rainfall overnight?
Well, in the 24 hours to 9am this morning, we did have a cold front that passed over yesterday afternoon, which did bring some rainfall to some parts of the state. We saw the highest falls out in the west, where there was generally 10 to 20 millimetres through parts out there. But through more central parts of the state, we did say maybe 1 to 5 up to 10 millimetres through parts. So some locations such as Ross recorded 4 millimetres, Campania 1.2, and some parts of the Fingal Valley had up to 2 millimetres of rain. And since 9am this morning, the only significant falls have been elevated peaks in the west.
Okay, well, now tell me about the outlook.
Well, we'll be stuck in this west to southwesterly airstream for much of the week. So we've got a ridge of high pressure from a very large ridge positioned south of WA extending over the state. And this is bringing a cooler air mass that's just pushing showers mainly into the west and far south. We're seeing some cooler temperatures, I suppose, tending towards 2 to 4 degrees below average. But for into tomorrow, showers into the west. Again, into Thursday, looking showers into the west. The possibility of some light showers Thursday afternoon about the northeast. This would amount to less than 5 millimetres, even possibly less than 2 millimetres. And then on Friday, with these westerlies continuing, we'll see a weak cold front embedded in this westerly flow that'll increase some showers into the west And then onto Saturday, this could push into central and southern parts, but not amounting to anything more than, say, 5 millimetres about the main parts of the state.
Any warnings?
We currently have a gale wind warning for southern, southeastern coastal waters between Tasman Island and southeast Cape for westerly winds. And then there is a strong wind warning for the remaining eastern and southern coastal waters between Wineglass Bay and Low Rocky Point. And as well into tomorrow, there's a strong wind warning remaining for those eastern and southern coastal waters from Wineglass Bay to Low Rocky Point.
Any more on coastal waters and swell?
Yeah, so with those winds west to southwesterly across all coastal waters, 15 to 25 knots, reaching up to 30 knots in the far south today. Winds are lighter about the northeast. This is quite similar wind pattern into tomorrow, with the winds about the northeast generally southwesterly 5 to 15 knots, although tending south to southwesterly 10 to 20 knots about the upper east coast in the evening. And with the swells today in the west and south, we've got a southwesterly of 3 to 4 metres with the significant wave height out of Cape Sorrel, wave rider buoy at 4 metres. And then there's also an east to northeasterly swell around 1 metre through parts of the south today. Now, into tomorrow, we see these swells build. So the west and south, this southwesterly swell will increase 3.5 to 4 metres and then building 5 to 6 metres during the afternoon. In the north today and tomorrow, it will remain a westerly at around 1 metre. And in the east today, it's a northeasterly 1 to 1.5 metres, as well as a southerly around 1 metre, tending more southwesterly 1.5 to 2.5 metres offshore in the south. And tomorrow we see the southerly swell building in the east up to 2.5 to 3.5 metres during the day and tending southwesterly 4.5 to 5.5 metres offshore in the south later.
Ellie Matthews, thanks very much.
Cheers, Fiona.
So, what makes us Australian?
Just be whoever you want to be.
And who's the obvious person to ask how that's transforming?
Welcome to Broken Hill, Miriam.
I'm on a quest to learn what it takes to change and adapt.
Occupation? I'm actually an escort.
An influencer. Mm-hmm.
Miriam Margolyes, Impossibly Australian.
You are changing the world.
Starts tonight at 8 on ABC TV and always free, always entertaining on ABC iView.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour. You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Thousands of Australian sheep and cattle on board a live export ship have arrived in Israel, more than 3 months after it first set sail, making it one of the longest in the industry's history. The animals spent more than 5 weeks on the MV Bahija after it was ordered to abandon its journey to the Middle East by the Australian government due to deteriorating regional security. An initial application to re-export them was refused as the ship sat off the port of Fremantle before the Federal Department of Agriculture approved sending them back on a longer route, avoiding the Red Sea. President of the WA Farmers spokesman, Jeff Pearson, says he's relieved the shipment finally made it.
The voyage was very successful. There's limited to zero mortalities in cattle and a handful of sheep. So, you know, which was expected, I suppose, but well below the reporting and expected levels. So the situation is in this that they, you know, we've exceeded all expectations and these animals have arrived safely in Israel.
And what about those expenses associated with this voyage? There at the thought of compensation?
I think there was some form of compensation looking to be sought by the exporter. I'm not involved in those negotiations, but you know, I did hear some rumours around the fact that the exporter was going to the department for some compensation because it's cost everybody, including the department, a lot of money. So that the fact that the decision made by the department wasn't in line with protocol, and then there could be some sort of form of compensation sought through the department for that matter.
And that was the president of Western Australia's Farmers Organisation, Jeff Pearson. Now, the daughter of champion racehorse Winx has set a new global filly yearling record, selling for $10 million at auction yesterday. The 18-month-old filly is now the most expensive yearling ever traded in the Southern Hemisphere. Winx won a record 33 straight races, and her daughter's sale drew international interest. But the filly will now stay in Australia after she was sold to Winx's part owner, Demi Capitis, and her Whoppet, Bloodstock.
I didn't come here to buy this horse originally. We put her up for auction, and then in the last few weeks, all of the family who started to miss our daughter, granddaughter. So we just decided that as best we could, if we could get her, we would. I am privileged to have been able to secure this filly on behalf of my family, to be able to hopefully see if she can get to the racetrack. If she can't get to the racetrack, she'll be an amazing mum. She's Australian forever, and she's going to be just fabulous. Hopefully she'll do her wings, but look, it doesn't matter if she doesn't.
And that was Debbie Capitis, and she paid $10 million for Winx's daughter. The Australian olive industry has relaunched a quality audit of local and imported olive oil. The Australian Olive Association will undertake the olive oil quality monitoring program to test the product on Aussie supermarket shelves. Association Chief Executive Michael Suthan says its testing regime will help give consumers confidence in olive oil.
The ongoing drought in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly affecting Spain, and the resulting shortage where they're probably only producing half of what they would normally produce, that puts pressures along many of the supply chains. And, you know, there could be areas where oils are being brought in that are not what they say they are, or not the quality that they say they are.
And after those little rural news snippets, it's time for a song. Let's go to Against All Odds by Phil Collins.
How can I just let you walk away? Just let you leave without a trace? When I stand here taking every breath, you're the only one who really knew me at all. How can you just walk away from me when all I can do is watch you leave? 'Cause we've shared the laughter and the pain.
And that was Against All Odds by Phil Collins. Now, the Fisheries Research and Development Corporation is taking a big step to building the skills of the next generation of stock assessment scientists, with a project aimed at getting more people on board. The FRDC has said with only about 100 stock assessment scientists currently available, with some heading towards retirement, it's a priority. The corporation says stock assessments are critical for determining the relative status of fish populations. Cathy Dichmont is a consultant who has been helping with a project that has included an online game that shows what the role could include.
Yeah, it's exactly how it sounds, it's counting the stock. So we're basically using mathematics and statistics to work out through scientific methods the population size and the condition of the resource and whether the resource is being managed sustainably. And if it's not, then what we need to do to be sustainable from a perspective of catch, for example.
And do you have to have any particular background to do this role?
Yeah, most people would be coming from the mathematics and statistics field. The other place people would be coming from is biology. It's actually a method that uses both mathematics stats on one hand and biology on the other hand. So if you start on the one side, which is, say, for example, biology, then you have to learn the math and stats to do it. And if you start on the stats side, then you have to learn the biology to do it. So you generally find it's a team group of people that work together to do this work rather than just one person.
And so this new project that you have been a part of to get more people involved in these roles, tell us about that.
Yeah, so the project is a capacity building project. So we're trying to work with the existing stock assessment people, but there's a lot of new recruits that have come into the area from various places. And we've been trying to change the way we work rather than just a set of individuals working on their own, creating a community feel and then also building on their knowledge. And the project's doing four things. Sort of one thing is trying to learn who the thought leaders are in the field and how they connect to each other, and how people outside can access those thought leaders. Changing the way we do courses by doing it as a community. So in other words, rather than one being done within an organisation, inviting people outside an organisation so that people can meet each other and learn in a community. A third part is to create tools and resources that are on the web, which is that web link I gave you, which tells you about what is available out in the big world in terms of really free stuff. And then the final one is this, the game that we did, which is learning from play. So allowing people to just, instead of doing something in real life, they get given a simulated resource and then try and see how well they do on that.
Tell us more about this game and what they had to actually do.
Yeah, so we basically, two of us in the project were the only ones that knew the answer. So we basically simulated a resource. It looked a little bit like an East Coast species, but people didn't know that, and because we put it into Pandora. And we basically then simulated the data set that people could get if they were trying to do an assessment. It was actually quite a difficult case study, so we didn't give them a simple case. So the species was tended to move from north to south and from the inshore to offshore. Quite a lot of fish in the East Coast do that. They get born, say, in seagrass and mangrove habitat and then move offshore as they get older. And so we simulated that, but they didn't know that. They just got the data, and they knew a little bit about the biology of a species. And we asked them to try and assess the resource. And because it was difficult, we were hoping that people would form teams, and that is exactly what happened. So people formed teams and worked together in groups of various sizes to do this assessment. And we asked people to then say, how did they go about it, what decisions they made, and also to ask them what was the stock status. And there was a prize in it for whoever came the closest.
Who was the overall winner?
Northern Territory Fisheries. They came the closest.
And so this game, was that essentially showing what they would be doing in real life in a stock assessment role?
Yes, it was trying to emulate what they would do in real life. The difference is, and I think that's why people were really attracted to it, was that in real life, you're managing a fishery and you're affecting people's income. So it has very serious consequences, and it's quite stressful to take risks, for example. So, you know, it's a bit like when you're driving a car and it's raining and there's lots of other cars, you're going to be a much more careful driver than when someone says, take your car and go on this empty road and there's no speed limit because it's a racing track, you know. So you're much more willing to play around with a car and see what it can do. And so that was exactly what we wanted them to do, was to take risks and to see what happens if I try it this way or the other way. So they, and that's exactly what they did.
Consultant Kathy Ditchmont speaking there with Brooke Neindorf.
Conversations.
Spend an hour in the life of someone else.
Not only would I have to climb the mountain, but I also needed a hell of a lot of money.
Someone who's seen and done remarkable things.
With Everest, I was absolutely petrified. The more I looked at it, the more I was smoking because I was so scared. You know, I'll never be able to get up that thing.
Richard Feidler and Conversations. Weekdays at 11 on the ABC Listen app and on digital radio from ABC Radio Hobart.
Keeping you updated every day. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen.
And in worrying news, the price of chocolate is probably going to rise again. Remember how you used to be able to get it for $4 a block just a couple of years ago? Well, chocolatier Igor Van Gerwen says the market for cacao has gone silly this year due to some supply problems.
We've got different methods, basically. Our cacao, the majority comes from Ghana, but we also purchase from Mexico, Peru, and even some from northern Queensland now as well. We make some on site just as trials more than anything else, and then we get factories contracted out to make our chocolate to our specifications, to my specifications. A lot of that is done overseas, so it could be Belgium, Switzerland, Singapore, wherever there's large chocolate equipment, the right equipment we want, they'll make it to our specifications, yeah.
It's quite a journey that all those ingredients go on to get here.
It is, yeah, and that's the process. So we, so the cacao is fermented on site, so on the farm, harvested, fermented, and dried, and then once we got the cacao beans, then we can ship them to wherever we can get them processed for us. Yeah, once I've done the trials here, yeah, yeah.
Igor, the all-important question, how are the prices for cacao at the moment?
The commodity market has gone silly, and that's the market where cocoa is based on. It's like a share market for commodities, I guess, and it's more than doubled within 7-8 months. So,
wow.
It's gone crazy, and there's been a lack of cacao in Ghana and Ivory Coast. Ivory Coast is the largest producer of cacao, and that's what the market is doing. So, we purchase through different methods, so it's affecting us only partly. But it could be a good thing for the farmers. The farmers haven't been paid properly for a long time. And this is going to help them. So there's always a silver lining in there.
There's a flip side to it, yeah.
Yes.
Yep. What's happening at the Ivory Coast and in Ghana that the price has gone up so much?
Yeah,
is that weather?
I've read so many different stories. Weather is one thing. Fertilizers that came from Ukraine, there's a lack of that. So I've heard so many different reasons, and it's hard to know which is spin and which isn't on the commodity market. But the fact is there's less cacao. So, yeah.
Is there anything to... I mean, I've heard stories of maybe people stockpiling a bit of cacao. Does that come into it at all?
Yeah, or just future buying. And that's what affects the price as well. It's what people are guessing is going to happen. We've purchased chocolate, our chocolate already in advance, which we do anyway, so it's not going to affect us a real lot. It's affecting us about 5% at the moment, but hopefully it'll get us through to Christmas, And then, yeah, we'll see. We're buffering it a bit. Yeah.
And what happens after Christmas?
We don't know yet. We'll see what happens to the pricing of cacao. Yeah.
Will you have to put up your prices this year, do you think?
We're looking at putting them up 5%, which is not a real lot compared to how high the cocoa is going. And not just the cocoa, sugar and dairy and, you know, all these things are involved, packaging, obviously. So, yeah, and we want to pay our staff a little bit more too. So it altogether, prices will go up, yeah. Look for quality. You can eat a little bit less and enjoy it more, yeah.
That was chocolatier Igor Van Gerwen there talking to Meg Powell. And eat a little bit less chocolate, Joel Reinberger. I don't think that's possible.
No. I will just have to, you know, refinance the house.
Yeah, well, it sounds
take
like
out a larger mortgage for the chocolates.
Well, he certainly makes special chocolate, but some of those mass brands, I'm sure they change the recipe sometime. And
look, they do. In fact, I was talking to John Zito, a chocolatier, a little while ago, and he was saying that you will see this shrinkflation is happening in chocolate by them just including less cacao in the actual chocolate. And he said, what is known as a luxury brand egg, Easter egg, which was a hazelnut Easter egg. And he said, and I could not really taste chocolate in it because they've just replaced cacao with fat of various types in it. And he said,
and you can taste that in chocolate when there's a lot of animal fat in it.
So that's kind of what I find I'm doing now is I'm actually going for the dark chocolate and I'm going for the nicer chocolate and a smaller amount.
Right.
Spending the same amount of money, I can tell you that much, but actually getting stuff that gives you that taste and gives you that satisfaction that chocolate gives you, because a lot of the other stuff, it's a lolly.
Yes.
It's basically unfrozen ice cream.
Sugary and fatty.
But it's not really chocolate. You know, chocolate has to have that silkiness about it and that bitterness about it. That's part of what makes it great is its bitterness alongside the sweetness.
So, okay, Joel. Well, what's happening in your program this afternoon?
Okay, look, I'm very excited about our review today. Tim Mark, because I've been watching the trailers and ads that have come up for this and I've gone, this looks great. I've never seen a movie like it, Monkey Man.
Now, I saw a review on it, but it's a pretty serious movie because I remember thinking, I need something light and fluffy tonight. I don't think I'll see that.
it's like a serious, fighty action film.
Right.
But it's Dev Patel.
Yes.
You know, who's known as this fabulous actor who's, you know, kind of halfway between Bombay and London. He's you know, one of those people who can you know, do English movies and do Indian movies.
He's not really serious and fighty, is he?
Oh, he is in this. He's got muscle on his muscles, and like it's a full on fighty action film. Wow. The soundtrack is just fantastic. This Indian rhythms and it appeals to me. I like things where people fight each other and go pew pew. So I'm looking forward to that, and especially when it's like when Liam Neeson did Taken, and he went from this serious actor suddenly to an action star in his 50s, and Dev Patel is doing that for himself because he also directed this. This is his directorial debut. Right. So fantastic. I'm very keen to hear what Tim thinks about that one. And have you heard the legend? You know how there's that weird brick wall halfway down the Botanical Gardens?
Yes.
Have you heard the legend that was built to keep the grasshoppers out?
No.
Apparently someone wrote that in a book some years ago, and it's repeated over and over again, and many people believe it, and it's utter garbage.
Where did that happen?
It's just like not true. Whispers. Someone just made it up because they saw a grasshopper on one side, and of course grasshoppers fly.
Yes, so, fly over fences.
Exactly. So we're going to find out the real story of the fence at the gardens.
Fantastic, Joel Reinberger. And I'll catch you again tomorrow on the Country Hour at noon.
Subscribe to the ABC Radio Hobart e-newsletter today. You'll get exclusive content, a first peek at the latest competitions, and program highlights delivered straight to your inbox.
Now we're talking Hobart.
To subscribe, head to abc.net.au/Hobart.